year, at least one in four Americans is diagnosed with a heart condition. At that point, there are some very important decisions to make for your future. The harsh reality may be you are left with more questions than answers. This is where the Heart Rhythm Center podcast can help. We are your what, why, and how of palpitations, heart rhythm disorders, pacemakers, and defibrillators. Welcome your host, Dr. Jeffrey L. Williams, board certified in internal medicine, cardiovascular disease, and clinical cardiac electrophysiology. The information included in this podcast is for educational purposes only. It is not intended or implied to be professional medical advice or a substitute for professional medical advice. Listeners should always consult their healthcare providers to determine the appropriateness of the information for their own situation, or if they have any questions regarding medical conditions or treatment plans.
This is Dr. Williams, and welcome to What Are Palpitations, Podcast 9, the Electrophysiology Study and Ablation Procedure. If medicines and lifestyle modifications are ineffective at relieving abnormal heart rhythms, your doctor may recommend an electrophysiology study and possible ablation. An EP study is a test of the electrical systems of your heart. It is usually done because you have had symptoms that indicate that your heart may occasionally be beating too fast or at times too slow. You will need to come to an EP laboratory, which is very similar to the special laboratory where heart catheterizations are performed to look for blockages in coronary arteries, to have this procedure done. The doctor will insert large intravenous sheaths, hollow tubes, into one or more of your big veins, usually in the groin, but possibly at other sites. The sheaths will be used by the doctor to thread special catheters into specific areas inside your heart. With these catheters, the doctor will evaluate the electrical system of your heart. The doctor may also try to cause your particular type of abnormal heartbeat so that he or she can see where it comes from and what makes it happen. If the doctor is successful in causing the abnormal heartbeat to occur, he or she may be able to demonstrate the same arrhythmia that was recorded in the outpatient setting. If the doctor is able to find a specific source for your abnormal heartbeat, he or she will steer a catheter to the spot in the heart that is triggering the arrhythmia. The doctor will advance the catheter to the identified spot and put a tiny burn, called ablation, on it with a special type of energy called radio frequency or cryoablation. Cryoablation uses supercool temperatures to freeze the areas. More than one application of energy is often needed. To get the catheter to the spot causing the abnormal rhythm, the doctor may need to put a tiny hole in the membrane that divides the two upper chambers of the heart to reach the left side of the heart. This is called a transseptal puncture. There are some important questions to ask your doctor before an EP study or ablation. The first, what is your training background? There is evidence that physician training, specifically board certification or board eligibility in clinical cardiac electrophysiology, may result in lower rates of complications. The second question is, how many EP studies and ablations have you done in your career? Doctors who have performed more ablations seem to have fewer complications than doctors with less experience. What complications have you seen is the final question. This question can be especially enlightening because it will give you an idea of whether the doctor has looked at his or her outcomes. A doctor who tells you that he or she has had no complications is misinformed or has not done enough procedures. Any doctor who performs procedures has complications. And a doctor who cares about patient outcomes will have done due diligence to minimize complications from happening again. That being said, there is generally no way to have no complications, but it is important to choose a doctor who has in-depth knowledge of possible complications. Preoperative risk assessment. As with all surgical procedures, recognizing and managing existing medical problems, also known as comorbid conditions, preoperatively helps to mitigate the risks during and immediately after EP studies. Many patients undergoing EP studies have heart failure, structural heart disease, and/or disease of the cardiac conduction system, which means that there is an inherently high-risk population of patients frequently served in the EP lab. Indeed, congestive heart failure, called CHF, increases the risk of all surgery. A decreased ejection fraction has been found to be a predictor of perioperative complications, with the highest risk group being those with an EF less than 35%. Pre-procedural management of CHF is integral to the safety of the procedure. Patients certainly should not be in a state of decompensated heart failure. The use of contrast agents during EP studies or ablations. Bones show up very well on x-rays. However, soft structures such as blood vessels and the heart do not. Therefore, blood vessels and heart structure are highlighted by contrast, which is a clear liquid designed for use during EP studies or ablations. The doctor may use fluoroscopy to guide the procedure. Fluoroscopy is a special type of imaging that allows the doctor to perform x-rays while the patient or the heart is moving. Fluoroscopy allows doctors to watch catheters and leads moving in the blood vessels and the heart so that we can place them in the correct location. A typical use of contrast for an EP study is during an ablation that is close to one of the coronary arteries, though this is not very common. Coronary arteriography is done to ensure that a patient's coronary artery is not near where we plan to perform an ablation. Delivering ablative energy near a coronary artery can lead to a blockage. If we feel that we are too close to a coronary artery, we can change the location of the catheter, or we may opt to stop the procedure. Contrast-induced nephropathy, or kidney failure, is a surprisingly common complication if radio contrast is given during a procedure. Contrast-induced nephropathy can occur in 15% of cases. It is a decline in kidney function assessed by checking the blood level of creatinine that typically peaks at 48 to 72 hours after exposure. Creatinine may remain above baseline for 7 to 14 days. Naturally, the best way to avoid this complication is to abstain from the use of contrast. Thankfully, we generally do not require much, if any, contrast during most EP studies and ablations. However, many patients undergoing EP studies are patients with heart failure and its associated comorbidities, which frequently include diabetes and chronic kidney disease. Therefore, a working knowledge of and respect for these agents is a necessity. There are several things I may do to limit the danger of kidney damage. They include 1, using a very weak, diluted contrast agent. 2, aggressively hydrating the patient, especially one with kidney disease at baseline. Hydration can usually be achieved with 4 to 6 glasses of water the evening before the procedure. And 3, holding medications that could worsen kidney damage during the procedure, such as angiotensin-converting enzyme inhibitors, angiotensin receptor blockers, and non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs can be held the day prior and the day of exposure and be resumed 24 hours after exposure. And medications such as sodium bicarbonate and N-acetylcysteine, called Mucomist, can be given prior to the procedure. Treatment of contrast-induced nephropathy is largely supportive, generally resolves on its own, and infrequently requires short-term dialysis. Contrast allergies, or immediately life-threatening allergic anaphylactic reactions, can include angioedema, which is face and throat swelling, bronchospasm, which is lung spasm, arterial hypotension, or low blood pressure, and shock can occur within minutes of and up to 60 minutes after injection of intravenous contrast. The reported incidence of severe immediate reactions to ionic contrast material is between 0.1 and 0.4%, and with the newer non-ionic and low osmolar or isoosmolar contrast, it is between 0.02 and 0.04%. But death rates from the two materials do not differ. Patients with even mild anaphylactoid or immediate reactions should be considered high-risk patients in future procedures involving contrast administration. It is common practice to pre-medicate with corticosteroids with or without histamine blockers, such as Pepcid, in patients with histories of moderate or severe immediate reactions, despite the fact that randomized trials comparing pretreatment strategies are severely lacking. Prior to any procedure that may involve contrast administration, it's essential that you inform your doctor about any history of previous contrast reaction, asthma, renal insufficiency, diabetes, and metformin therapy. Routine pre-medication of all patients who receive contrast is probably not warranted, given the overall low incidence of a reaction. In fact, some have advocated abandoning this procedure. Patients with a history of severe contrast allergy who will likely need IV contrast during a procedure should probably receive pre-exposure treatment with corticosteroids such as prednisone or hydrocortisone, as well as H1 blockers, although strong evidence of benefit is lacking. If contrast administration cannot be delayed for 4 to 6 hours after steroids, some doctors will omit steroid use and administer only H1 blockers. Weaker agents, such as low osmolar or isoosmolar contrast, should be used due to the lower overall incidence of reactions in patients with a history of asthma or a contrast allergy. The specific contrast agent causing the prior reaction should be sought and avoided if possible, although this information is often difficult for your doctor to obtain. Despite pretreatment with steroids and H1 blockers, reactions are still possible in those with prior reactions. Thyroid issues. Hypothyroidism or low thyroid function has been found in 0.5 to 0.8% of the population. It is demonstrated by elevated serum levels of thyroid-stimulating hormone, TSH, or decreased serum thyroxine levels. Undiagnosed, and hence untreated, hypothyroidism can lead to major perioperative complications, including severe hypotension or low blood pressure, or cardiac arrest following induction of anesthesia. Extreme sensitivity to narcotics and anesthetics with prolonged unconsciousness and hypothyroid coma following anesthesia and surgery. Ideally, hypothyroidism is caught early in the preoperative evaluation, and a thyroid supplement, thyroxine, may be administered until the patient's thyroid function is normalized, generally in 4 to 6 weeks. Hyperthyroidism, or high thyroid function, affects approximately 0.2% of men and 2% of women and may cause atrial fibrillation, congestive heart failure, and a reduction in the number of blood cells, called thrombocytopenia. In addition, anesthetic drugs may be affected by the hypermetabolic state of hyperthyroidism. When total IV anesthesia is used, an increased dose of sedatives may be needed because these agents are processed more quickly with a hyperactive thyroid. In my practice at the Heart Rhythm Center, this may occur when high-frequency ventilation is used to minimize respiratory motion during procedures. Generally, more thyroid-related perioperative complications stem from hypothyroidism as opposed to hyperthyroidism. However, recognition of either condition prior to EP study is important. At the Heart Rhythm Center, we usually obtain TSH prior to EP studies, and we often allow 4 to 6 weeks for the patient's thyroid function to normalize prior to proceeding with surgery. Emergent cases with thyroid abnormalities require close coordination with anesthesiology and will generally be undertaken with general anesthesia. Allergies. Obviously, your doctor should be aware of any drug allergy or prior concerning reaction to any medication. The first exposure to a medication often causes a minor reaction, but the second exposure can lead to a fatal allergic reaction called anaphylaxis. It is also important to let your doctor know if you have had any reactions to other substances. Knowledge of a prior reaction to IV contrast agents, such as during a computed tomography, CT scan, or cardiac catheterization, or latex gloves, can enable your doctors to avoid using these agents or give preventive medications called prophylaxis so that an adverse reaction is minimized. Prophylaxis may include the use of steroids and antihistamines. Steroids such as prednisone and hydrocortisone are often used preoperatively. In addition, antihistamines such as diphenhydramine or Benadryl and famotidine called Pepcid are given to reduce the severity of a possible allergic reaction. Registration and check-in. Patients generally undergo EP studies at the hospital and require an overnight stay. Rarely do patients go home the same day as an EP study that includes an ablation, although this can happen. Some doctors operate at multiple hospitals, so it is important to verify the hospital at which the procedure is to be done. The patient will generally check in with registration and then go to the appropriate holding area, preoperative or pre-op unit. This is a staging area where the patient changes into a gown, an IV is started, and hospital documentation is performed. Prior to the procedure, the patient is asked multiple times to state his or her name and the type of procedure that is to be performed. Questions often seem redundant, such as, do you have any allergies? What surgery are you here for? But this fact-checking process is an attempt to minimize any chances of medical error. Many doctors will meet their patients in the holding area to answer any last-minute questions and confirm that all preoperative tests are complete and the surgery can proceed. The informed consent process is one of the most important aspects of any medical procedure. It is more than just getting a patient to sign the consent form. This is the process by which a patient is informed of the diagnosis and the nature and purpose of the proposed treatment or procedure. The patient should understand the risks and benefits of the proposed EP study, as well as the risks and benefits of any alternative treatments, such as medications or watchful waiting. This podcast can be used as part of the informed consent process because it covers all aspects of arrhythmia evaluation in a more thorough manner than can be presented in even multiple office visits. It is during this process that patients can make sure they fully understand the rationales for their EP studies and can ask any questions they might have for the physician. Some physicians go over these risks, benefits, and alternatives in the office and have their patients more thoroughly review and read the consent form at home prior to surgery. Once the patient has completed the required elements in the holding area and the informed consent process is completed, he or she is brought into the procedure room. The procedure room may be a standard operating room or may be a specialized cardiac catheterization laboratory where heart catheterizations are usually performed that has been converted or altered to perform EP studies. A timeout, once the patient is in the procedure room, occurs when the doctors, nurses, technologists, and all other personnel who are participating in the surgery stop what they are doing before the patient is sedated and identify the patient, the procedure being performed, including site of implant, the technique to be used, and any other important patient information such as drug allergies. The timeout is usually performed to minimize the occurrence of any medical errors, such as performing an EP study in the wrong patient. At this point, the procedure can be started. Most patients are sedated for the EP study. Conscious sedation involves giving medications that relax the patient and relieve pain but allow the patient to breathe on his or her own. Conscious sedation can be administered by nurses in the room or by anesthesiologists. General anesthesia involves deep sedation, and it often requires a temporary breathing tube and a connection to an artificial ventilator. General anesthesia is administered by anesthesiologists or specially trained nurses called Certified Registered Nurse Anesthetists, or CRNAs. The higher the risk of surgery, the more often general anesthesia is used. General anesthesia may permit tighter control of patient heart rate and blood pressure and allow the patient to remain absolutely still during the procedure. These elements may permit a safer procedure as well as a more pleasant experience for the patient. The EP study is performed in an operating room or cardiac procedure room that includes sterile supplies, an adjustable patient table, and an X-ray system called fluoroscopy. Please see my blog at heart-rhythm-center.com to see a typical EP procedure room. The C-arm holds the X-ray equipment that the physician uses to guide the catheters into their correct positions. This technique of using X-rays to guide catheter placement is called fluoroscopy. The screens display patient information such as EKG and blood pressure and show the X-ray images. The anesthesia equipment and anesthesiologist are at the head of the bed. A special sterile table holds all the instruments and equipment that will be used during the EP study. The EP study usually involves placing multiple catheters in the femoral veins. These are the large veins found in the groin creases. Your doctor may also place a catheter in a femoral artery to monitor blood pressure, and rarely place a catheter in the artery to access certain parts of your heart not easily reached via the veins. Catheters are sometimes placed in the large veins of your neck, the internal jugular. These veins lead to your heart. Let's go through the operative steps of EP studies. First, sterile preparation and draping of the patient occur on the operating table. Next, the patient is sedated. Then specialized personnel prepare the right or left groins and cover the rest of the patient with sterile gowns. The EP physician washes his or her hands and then puts on sterile gown and gloves. Lidocaine is used to numb the skin where the vascular access will be placed. These sites are usually in the femoral veins located in the creases of your groin. The femoral vein, and sometimes artery, is punctured with a needle and a wire is placed through this needle. The needle is withdrawn, leaving the wire in the blood vessel. Over this wire, a hollow tube called a sheath is placed, and a catheter that can measure electrical activity is placed through the sheath. This is repeated for each catheter the doctor needs to place into your heart. Once the doctor places all the necessary sheaths and catheters into your heart, the doctor begins to make baseline electrical measurements of your heart's conduction system. After the baseline measurements are obtained, the doctor will then use special pacing maneuvers in an attempt to cause an arrhythmia. Hopefully, the induced arrhythmia is the same one you experienced at home. The vascular access, baseline measurements, and arrhythmia induction may take several hours. Ultimately, an ablation may be performed. The entire EP study and ablation may take as long as 4 to 6 hours. Finally, the catheters are withdrawn from your heart, the sheaths removed, manual pressure is applied to help stop the bleeding, and the patient is awakened from sedation and returned to the recovery area. How does the doctor place catheters inside your heart? The doctor uses a special real-time X-ray system called fluoroscopy to position the EP catheters inside your heart via your veins. electrophysiologists complete many years of training to learn how to carefully place these catheters. What happens if your doctor cannot successfully find an arrhythmia? This sometimes happens, although it is disappointing for both you and your doctor. On the one hand, if we couldn't find the arrhythmia, it is usually reassuring that we are not dealing with a particularly dangerous arrhythmia. On the other hand, the patient may still experience symptoms once he or she is back at home. Usually, I try to demonstrate the arrhythmia before subjecting a patient to an EP study. That is, we try various types of home monitoring to record an arrhythmia that is causing the symptoms. If we are unable to capture an arrhythmia on some type of home monitoring, it is more likely that we won't be able to cause or induce an arrhythmia during an EP study. What happens if my doctor cannot successfully ablate the arrhythmia? Unsuccessful ablation attempts can also be disappointing. Some arrhythmias can be caused in the EP lab, but despite multiple attempts, they cannot be successfully pinpointed and ablated. This could be due to several factors: patient movement, an arrhythmia focus on the outside wall of the heart, or an arrhythmia focus deep in the heart muscle. Sometimes patients with AV node reentrant tachycardia have an arrhythmia focus that is very close to the conduction system. Placing burns too close to the native conduction system could cause complete heart block and necessitate pacemaker implantation. AV nodal reentrant tachycardia, called AVNRT, atrioventricular reentrant tachycardia, called AVRT, and typical atrial flutter tend to have high success rates, up to 95% single procedure success rates. Success rates for ablation need to be balanced with the risks of complication for each type of ablation. Indeed, as we discussed previously, ablations for atrial fibrillation and ventricular tachycardia in patients with advanced coronary artery disease tend to have higher rates of complications and lower rates of successful ablations, often 60 to 70% single procedure success rates. Of patients undergoing an ablation for atrial fibrillation, approximately 15% of patients may require a repeat ablation within 1 year of the initial procedure, and approximately 30% of these patients will require a repeat ablation within 3 years of the initial procedure. Of patients undergoing an ablation for ventricular tachycardia, 60% will have recurrent VT within 6 months of the initial procedure. Immediately after the EP study, once the patient is awake with no obvious complications, he or she is generally observed in the hospital overnight, although some centers may offer to send patients home the same day. The doctor will usually talk to the patient and his or her family about the procedure. The discussion with family or friends is important. The patient may not remember events in the immediate postoperative period because of the sedatives given during the procedure. At the Heart Rhythm Center, our patients are generally kept lying in bed for 4 to 6 hours after the EP study. They can eat once they are awake and alert after the procedure. We keep a sterile dressing on the vascular access sites until the next morning when we examine the area. The day after the EP study. The morning after the EP study, the vascular access sites are inspected by the doctor, a nurse, or an assistant. Generally, the incision can be left without a gauze dressing, as long as the incision care instructions in the next section are followed. If there is any oozing, clean, dry gauze can be placed over the incision to protect clothing from blood staining. Once the vascular access sites are found to be healthy, the patient is ready to go home. The electrophysiologist may not see the patient the day after the EP study, but the physician's team will be very familiar with care following an EP study and the process of arranging discharge from the hospital. Please note that some EP studies and ablations, such as those for atrial fibrillation or ventricular tachycardia, may require a patient to stay in the hospital for more than one night. Advanced treatment options for atrial fibrillation. Sometimes medications may not be enough to control symptoms from atrial fibrillation. If catheter ablation of atrial fibrillation is not sufficient to reduce symptoms, there are open heart surgery options, for example, a Mays procedure that may be appropriate for some patients. If a patient is not considered a candidate for atrial fibrillation ablation, one of these surgical options and all else fails, an AV node ablation can be considered. This procedure prevents the atria from sending rapid electrical signals to the ventricles, but atrial fibrillation will still continue. A pacemaker is then implanted so the ventricles continue to beat properly. After the AV node ablation and pacemaker implantation, your atria continue to fibrillate and anticoagulation to reduce the risk of stroke is still necessary. An AV node ablation and pacemaker implantation can be a great option in elderly patients that have difficulty tolerating the medications, such as beta blockers and calcium channel blockers, used to control atrial fibrillation and slow the heart rates. Thanks for listening to the Electrophysiology Study an ablation procedure, and I hope you'll join me for podcast 10, The Possible Complications of Electrophysiology Studies and Ablations.
Thank you for listening to the Heart Rhythm Center. If you have enjoyed this episode and would like to access extensive explanations of topics discussed today, together with helpful illustrations, head over to www.heart-rhythm-center.com, where a full list of available publications on Amazon can be easily accessed. That's www.heart-rhythm-center.com. And please subscribe to the Heart Rhythm Center blog, as well as Dr. Williams' author page on Amazon, where his books discussing arrhythmias, pacemakers, and defibrillators are available in print and electronic Kindle versions.